Reading is from Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13, through to chapter 53, verse 12. And if you'd like to follow along in the black Bibles in front of you, it's on page 731. Isaiah chapter 52. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. So will he sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living, for the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong. Because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors.
Good morning. Good to see you. Let me add my welcome to the Barnes family. It's good to see you here. Welcome. It's great to be with us. For us to be with you as well, my name is John. I'm the senior minister here, and I hope that everyone can hang around afterwards for a cup of coffee. That would be a good thing. You know, one of the most alluring smells in the world, in my humble opinion, is that of a freshly baked chocolate cake. Because, you know, if you get one of those, you will have one of the most stomach-nourishing, sensational things that the world has ever known. If you can just get it warm, straight out of the oven. It's just unbelievable. One day I got home from work, and as I opened the door, the smell of a freshly baked chocolate cake met me at the front door and welcomed me into my home. And I followed its alluring smell all the way to the kitchen, where on the bench was this luscious, rich chocolate cake, there all on its own, steam still rising from the surface. I could not hear anybody in home. I could not see anybody in the home. And I had heard that it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. everything was really okay because there was a nice, moist, rich chocolate sensation covering every taste bud across my tongue as I let it slide all the way down and just fill me up. Everything was really fine until sometime later, this blood-curdling scream echoed out of the kitchen. My name was tagged to that. I didn't know Robin had made it for a meeting she was having later that night. And after 4 or 5 years, I think everything is forgiven. It's a relief to be forgiven, but is my chocolate cake experience of forgiveness, is that all there is to forgiveness? Someone expresses their indignation, and a little while later they say, ah, forget about it. Is that forgiveness? A child stays out late beyond curfew, and you express your indignation when they come home, and then you say, ah, forget it, go to bed. Is that forgiveness? A man appears before a court, and the evidence makes it painfully clear that he is guilty of abducting a little girl out of her bed, raping her and murdering her. The jury convicts him. The judge expresses his indignation and captures up the community's indignation. And when he's finished, he simply says, ah, forget it. Is that forgiveness? Is chocolate cake forgiveness appropriate when significant, serious crime has been committed? Is forgiveness that cheap? We're in a series in the ancient prophecy of Isaiah. It's in the Old Testament. Isaiah, as we've learnt, has this magnificent vision of a kingdom which is that God's people were not being just, and God is appalled at their injustice because the poor and the weak, the defenceless, are being mistreated, oppressed, and exploited. God made his indignation extremely clear to us at the very beginning. Last week we heard that God continues to love us and he says, I will forgive you. But here's the question. How can he say, I forgive you to a man who abducted, raped and murdered a little girl? How can he do that? How can God be angry with injustice at the beginning of this work called Isaiah and then partway through simply use words that say, I forgive you, and not deal with the justice of that matter? How can he be appalled at injustice and apparently not exercise justice as he forgives? How can he do that? That is the question. Now, what if we were to find ourselves transported right now from here to the Ivory Coast? And we find ourselves in a number of farms where there are child slaves. What if we were transported to Thailand in brothels? We saw 10, 11, 12-year-old girls who are being used and held prisoners to satiate the lust of Western men. What if we were transported to those places and God were to say, I will forgive them, their captors. I will forgive the captors. What if he were to say that? Would we think that they were words that were appropriate, or were they hollow? What if we were transported to the killing fields of Cambodia or to Rwanda or Tasmania of the late 1800s? Would God's promise to forgive the mass murderers be appropriate, or would they be obscene? These questions can only intensify in our minds when we realize that God has seen not only the things I've mentioned, but he has seen rape and brutality and exploitation and bloodshed and oppression for millennia. And he has heard the cries of the women and children, the poor and the homeless, the powerless and the victim since time began. How can he say, I will forgive you? How can he say to child molesters and exploiters and to those who turn a blind eye to child slavery while eating chocolate, I will forgive them? How can he forgive those whose words and actions and inaction mistreat, abuse and destroy people in this city? It is these questions that the ancient prophet Isaiah deals with this morning, as he teaches us about the kingdom of God without compromise. Without compromise. And what he has to say to us is dumbfounding. But it will bring release and it will bring joy. And so we begin in Isaiah 52 verse 13. If you have a Bible, open that up to make sure I'm not pulling a rabbit out of a hat for you. Open it up for me. So it's Isaiah chapter 52 verse 13. Someone got a page number because I've forgotten that. 731, if you want to look along in the black Bibles, that'd be great. In chapters 52 and verse 12, this is how Isaiah says God will deal with it. He says, see, look, my servant, he will act wisely. He will be raised up and lifted up and highly exalted. And just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so defigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond any human likeness, so he will sprinkle many nations. He will come and be a high priest. He will sprinkle blood on the nations to cleanse them from their sins. Well, what is this servant like? Have a look at chapter 53 with me in verse 2. He grew up before God like a tender shoot, like a root out of the dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men turn their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. He is a servant of nondescript. And secondly, he is God forsaken. Look at verse 4. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, and we considered him stricken by God, God forsaken. And then he is crushed by God. Look at verse 10, where Isaiah says, chapter 53, verse 10, it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. Now, this is a bloody chapter. And so I'll take you to places where you may feel uncomfortable, but you need to see it. There's a new sport that's come into our country recently. It's called Ultimate Fight Championship Challenge, whatever it's called. Anyone know? UFC is the initials anyway. Anyone heard of it? A few of us, okay. I have heard of it, and one of my sons was channel surfing and come across it, and I had to turn my head. This is how UFC works. It's a fight between two men who are multidisciplined in martial arts, number of martial arts they have, and they are locked in a cage about the size of a boxing ring. The only protection they wear, apart from groin protection, is a very thinly padded glove, which looks like something weightlifters might use. Not much on it. It's not like a boxing glove. There is a referee. Why? I don't know. They go in and the object is to beat the other within an inch of their life. Whoever is standing at the end wins. The piece I saw showed a cut under the eye, which is sort of okay, I can cope with that, I've played football, and then another blow produced a cut across the forehead, which meant claret flowed in unprecedented measure. Blood flowed profusely and the fight continued. One is to crush the other to within an inch of their life. This servant in the servant song here is crushed by God, not to within an inch of his life, until his life is taken. The servant is subbed for us. It's as though we're in the cage and God says, time out, pull that person out, bring my servant in. He is going to be subbed and he will be crushed for them. So Isaiah 53 verse 5 tells us he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquity, for our sin, for our wrongdoing. He was crushed. God took us out of the cage, subbed the servant and then crushed him to death. And then on top of that, he is a guilt offering. So chapter 53 and verse 10 again, it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he's a guilt offering. Now, get this, at the very beginning, I pointed out that the servant was to be a priest, to come and sprinkle the blood of a sacrifice over the nations so that the nations would be clean. Now we're told this servant is the sacrifice. It is his blood that will sprinkle the nations and make them clean. Now, my friends, this is a stunning transformation. This servant is none other than the one we saw seated on a throne back in Isaiah 6, who is holy and righteous, who is there to rule the world and bring peace to it. That one is taken off the throne, and that one is crushed in our place as a guilt offering. And we're told in verse 12 that as he's being made a guilt offering, he prays. He makes intercession. He pleads our case to the Father. Now that piece alone, but along with a couple of other details that you can look up later in verse 9 and verse 12, tell us that this can only be Jesus when he was strung up on a cross. The intercession he prayed echoes up and down the halls of history, and they keep ringing out, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." It's a stunning prayer. "Father, forgive them as they pound the nails in, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive the torturers who torture children, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive the mass murderers who wipe out a whole generation because they know not what they do. Father, forgive the liars and the greedy, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive them all." And we're told in verse 11 that this guilt offering is made to justify many. It's as if we had never sinned. Jesus' death is sufficient. It's totally sufficient. It's more than sufficient to forgive all the sin of all the people who have ever lived and ever will live. It is more than sufficient for all of that. And this exorbitant fee for forgiveness has been paid, which is why God can say, "I will forgive them." Now, it's worth pausing here for a moment. Jesus willingly paid the price of forgiveness because he willingly substituted himself in the cage in the UFC of all time, because he knew that you and I could not be crushed and survive, because the penalty of sin is death. We could not be crushed and survive. So Jesus willingly did that. Now, I have to stop and think about that. A number of years ago, when my eldest son Ben was quite small, about 6 or 7. We were at a church weekend away, and it was evening, as I recall, and I was sitting down enjoying dessert. Food is an important part of life. I was sitting down enjoying dessert when I heard over the din and the chatter of people in the room this cry, and I thought, "That sounds familiar." I lifted my ear up and then my eye up and looked up to see a friend of mine carrying my son in his arms and blood just flowing profusely out of his head. So I pushed back my chair and I was pushing people out of the road. In fact, I pushed another friend, Andrew, who was taking his son very carefully in a pram, negotiating around tables to get him to somewhere he needed to go. I pushed Andrew out of the road, jumped over his son's pram, praying that I wasn't going to kick his son out of the pram. And I was doing everything I could to get to my son because blood was flowing profusely. What happened was he was running around while kids were playing baseball, and as someone took a backswing, cracked him in the head. Okay, you know, blood everywhere, and I'm pushing people out of the road. My friends I'm pushing out of the road. So, I like all of you, but if my children are in here and something disastrous takes place and they can't get out, I will walk all over you to get my children out, because I love them more than I love you. And you would say the same thing back. But God sends his son to crush him as our substitute. Does that not say that you are valuable to him? And he justifies many, just as if I'd never sinned. He justifies many. The many are those who respond and say, "I'll take that. I'm glad he's the substitute. I'm in." And then God fulfills a promise from way back at the beginning of Isaiah that though your sins are as scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. I offer a new day to you because my son was crushed to death for you. This is how God can say, I forgive you. This is how he says, I forgive you and you and you and you and me. Duk knows this. Duk is a Christian pastor in Cambodia. But in the 1970s, when Pol Pot was having his murderous way in Cambodia, Duk was the warden of the Khmer Rouge's notorious Tuol Sleng prison. Duk was one of the bloodiest mass murderers this world has ever known. He is responsible for the torture and death of 17,000 Cambodians, men, women, children, and infants. In 1996, however, the enormous weight of his past was such that he was under enormous, profound depression, and he approached Pastor Lapel in Cambodia to receive the forgiveness of his sins. Duk is now in Cambodian prisons, waiting the outcome of the trial for his crimes. He will have to suffer the consequences of his crimes against his countrymen. And Duk says that he will do so willingly. And he will do so knowing that God has forgiven him. He will do so knowing that God has meted out justice even for his crimes on God's Son 2,000 years ago. Because God substituted Jesus for Duk's sins. It is no wonder at the beginning of our Bible reading this morning, we read that the kings will shut their mouths because of him. We stand in silence. What else can you say? That man, he is forgiven? Yes. Yes. God's willingness to pay the exorbitant price for forgiveness is simply shockingly stunning. His forgiveness is not cheap, nor is it offered without thought. It is the most sublime forgiveness the world will ever know. It's a forgiveness that's still available to you and to you and to you. It's still available to you. It's still available. Well, you need to pause for a moment again, because what God did throws strong light on this servant's death. Strong light. It throws strong light on our sin. Our sin. Sin is not a small matter. Small matters do not cause the death of a son. And when we see that, when we sin, we need to come to God with a broken heart, because our sin means that this servant was crushed in our place. Sin is not a small matter. We cannot say, I will contribute my good works to this either, like a denomination does in our city. Jesus did a fair bit, but there's a bit left over, so if we contribute good works, that's enough. You know why we can't do that? Because the book of Isaiah tells us in chapter 64, verse 6, I'm going to take you to a place that's really uncomfortable right now. Isaiah 64, 6 says that your and my righteous acts, which are used to try and please God, to get forgiveness from God, they are nothing but, the NIV translates, as filthy rags, which sounds nice, but our translators are very sanitized. The image is that of a used menstrual cloth. For us to say we'll contribute our righteous deeds to try and win God over, God says that's like sticking a used menstrual cloth in my nose. We cannot add to the good works that we can't add good works to what Jesus has done, because that's an insult, isn't it? Jesus was crushed for our sin. How dare we think that we can bring something to add to that? This is not something we can ignore. Like, roll the tape ahead. Roll the tape ahead. To the end of time, we find ourselves standing before our Maker. He may ask a question like this. It's not hard to believe he could not. He just may ask this question. What did you make of what John Gray said on February 28, 2010 at St. Paul's Anglican Church? What did you make of that?
How did you respond to Jesus subbing for you? Did you respond with faith or did you just walk away? What did you do? Now, I can imagine someone saying, well, you know, I did think about it. I went home because I'd never heard that stuff before. I went home and thought about it. But after some thinking over a cup of coffee and stuff, I concluded I really don't need Jesus. And so I guess I don't think his death was really that important, really. Now, if it gets to that point, I could imagine God saying something like this. So let me get this right. I did all that I could to protect you from being crushed. I took you out of the cage and substituted my son for you. I did everything I could to protect you. I subbed him in the cage for you, but you thought it was nothing? Do you think I am mad? And with a range of emotion, possibly, indignation and anger and frustration and sadness, and possibly with a tear in his eye, God may well say to a person who thought that Jesus' death was nothing, he may well say to such a person, so, you wanted to do it without Jesus subbing for you? Okay, that's what you get to do. And so, go to hell. If you are thinking that Jesus' death is not that important, if you are thinking you can bring your good works and contribute them to Jesus in order to get God's forgiveness, if you are thinking that what I'm saying is a waste of time and a waste of space, I beg you to consider it again. I beg you to re-listen to what I'm saying. This is far too significant to simply walk away from. And if you've only heard this the first time in your life, please think about it. Your life now and forever hangs on it. It's too big to walk away. Come and talk to me afterwards. I'll be out the back in the visitor's lounge. Come and talk to me. But for those who, like Duke, have come to Jesus and have had their sins forgiven, it's a new day. It's a new start. It's a fresh start. And we get to do a couple of things. We get to join a whole group of people. Chapter 54, verses 1 to 3, you can read that later. We get to join a whole burgeoning group of people, which fulfills a promise to Abraham that God would make Abraham a great nation. Secondly, what we get to join is much better than the utopias of ancient worlds and modern worlds. It's much better than simply a world without tears or pain. It's much better than Mel Gibson and his dreams and his movies. I don't know whether you've seen the last movie or not, but certainly in Braveheart and the last movie, Mel tends to think that when you die, loved ones who you love dearly will come and find you and walk with you into the misty future and everything will be sweet and fine. As much as that dream longs deep within us, God has a much richer one. Because this guilt offering, we're told, he will rise from the dead. And we know that to be true. We celebrate that at Easter. He rose from the dead, which means he will be God with his people. God with us. He will be Emmanuel. Emmanuel. And that's made clear in chapter 54, verses 4 and following. God will live with us like a loving husband to a tender bride. And then finally, this one, what he offers is not just for us, but according to 54, the rest of 54, 9 through 10, this is for the world. This is for the world. If the people would come, this is for them. And so God says to us right now, I'm in the last slide, thanks. And right now God says, come. Come. Come, he says. Chapter 55. Come, all you who are thirsty. Come to the waters. And you have no money. Come, buy and eat. Come. Come without money, without cost. Why spend money on bread that your labor and your labor that does not satisfy? Listen to me, says God, and eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Come, he says. And if you've wandered away from Jesus and wonder whether he'll ever accept you back, he says, come. Come, and your soul will delight in the richest affair. And if you would like to come for the first time, or for the second time, or the 22nd time, come and meet us out the back, and we'll happily talk with you and help you take the next couple of steps so that you can enjoy all that God wants you to enjoy, which means that we will not live in fear anymore. We'll not live under condemnation anymore, because the knowledge that we are forgiven, it comes with a deep and priceless forgiveness, and we are set free. And so, ladies, if you are a daughter of God, you are his treasured possession. The very thought of you brings a smile of such warmth to his face that if you could see it, it would simply melt your heart. And men, if you are a son of God, if you have come, God is so proud of you, you better step back, because just in case a shirt button pops off and hits you in the eye, his chest is so proud of you. We can do all of this. We can enjoy all of this because God's kingdom has been opened up because he refused to compromise on forgiveness.